Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Rowing Chat. I'm Rebecca Caro, and this week, Rowing Chat is sponsored by my book, Rowing Tales. I don't need to give myself any money for it, but you should go and get Rowing Tales. It's on Amazon. It's a good book, and you can also get it on the Row Perfect shop. It's got lots of short stories on rowing themes, from disaster at Henley to novice success, from capsized swimming to seeing the perfect sunrise. You're gonna love it. So get yourself a copy of Rowing Tales today. And if you fancy telling your story for the 2018 Rowing Tales book, get in touch. I'd love to hear it. Now today on Rowing Chat, I'm joined by Geroit Towie. Gags, welcome, hello.
Thank you very much. Hello to you too.
So, who are you and what's your background in rowing?
Well, I'm an ex-Irish international rower. Started rowing at the age of 10 back in 1987 in Cork. And I represented Ireland from 1993 at the Coupe. It was my first kind of big event. Did two junior worlds and then went into the senior lightweight team in 1995, continued through until 2008 with the team, went to three Olympics and won one championship gold and three bronze at senior level. So yeah, it was a long career, but it was fun.
That's what we like to hear. Now, can you get your mouth a little closer to the microphone just for sound volume?
Yeah, is that better?
And delightful to have you on the show. We've obviously met a few times, but we actually met as a result of your current project, which is called Crossing the Line Sport. What is Crossing the Line?
So Crossing the Line is a service for athletes to assist them to prepare for life after sport or to deal with life after sport. So we work with athletes who have retired and also athletes who are still competing, who are getting ready to retire. So it's a preventative service as well as a reactive service. So it's all based around athlete mental health and life after sport. So the idea came from, my own experience of retirement. So I retired after Beijing 2008. I actually retired the year before, 2007, and made a comeback for 2008. So that should have been a signal that retirement wasn't going to be as easy as I thought, because, you know, there's a big adjustment to be made after you finish. And I went back in 2008 because I probably subconsciously didn't want to answer the questions about what I was going to do afterwards. So retired properly 2008. And, I actually went into acting, went to drama school in London for a year, which I had auditioned for before the Olympics. The reason for that was because I always wanted to try it. And secondly, because, you know, I wanted to be in a position where I was learning stuff again. When you get to that end of your career in any sport, I think your ability to learn new things is diminishing, and actually you have to work very, very hard to make very small changes. And I was keen to get into something where I knew nothing and I could learn stuff, and it was very refreshing. It was great fun. It was brilliant. I really enjoyed it. But, you know, the life of an actor is, you have to be an Olympic level actor to be making any money at any kind of level. So I wasn't at that level. So I was thinking to myself, I'm going to have to bury myself, to work really hard to make it in this profession. And I just wasn't up for it at that point in time. So then that's when I kind of decided, okay, so what am I going to do? And that was the first. And I actually didn't have an answer to that for the first time in my life, because if you think about it, like from the age of 10 or age of 12 or whatever, when you started rowing in the first place, you always had an answer to the question, who are you and what are you doing with your life? Because you could always say, I'm rowing and trying out for the Olympics. I'm all that kind of stuff. So yeah, sort of getting or not being able to answer that question, very simple question, was it was a bit shocking really, and I wasn't expecting it at all. So then I guess I started to then try to delve into what it was I was going to do to sustain me for the next 60 years of life. I started to notice that this was a question that a lot of athletes were trying to answer for themselves. And when I first started to, question all this stuff, I actually went online looking for an athlete online support place where, you know, I might be able to get some information or read some stories or whatnot on this topic. And there was nothing. It was just an empty space. And there was a couple of articles and, you know, kind of academic articles that were very hard to read. And that was it. So I kind of got the idea then that, like, oh, there's a kind of a gap here that needs to be filled. But I didn't actually do anything about it for another 5 or 6 years. I kind of was reluctant to get back into sport again. And I knew that starting something in this arena would be involved getting back into the sporting world, and I just wanted to give it a rest. So in the meantime, I started a company doing something else completely different, which is an events company. I had that for about 3 years, based in Dublin, and it was adventure races, running races, all cycling races, kind of organizing all that kind of stuff. Really enjoyed it, but it was a one-man band, and I guess you could say I did my MBA when I was doing that business, because I was doing everything, even the stuff that I wasn't good at, I still had to do. So that was very good, actually, in terms of learning how to run a business and learning what I was good at and what I wasn't so good at. So that then when I could move on to my next business, I knew exactly what I would have to try and get others to help me with and what I could focus on for myself that I knew I could do. So the crossing the line idea never went away. Even after 3 years of running this other business, I went back into the area, looked in and see, has anyone started doing this yet? And nobody had started it. So I said, okay, if I don't do it, I might regret not doing it. So that's how I started it.
Fantastic. And you were kind enough to tell me very early on about what you were working on. And when I started looking online, I definitely saw a lot of the outward symptoms of a problem with an athlete who had retired. And often these were couched in news stories about people with financial problems, people with addiction problems, whether it's gambling or money or drugs or alcohol. And those symptoms seem to be recurring and repeating. Would you say that's normal?
Yeah, it is pretty typical. You know, without the right guidance, people will go down, you know. I guess the way of explaining it is that, like, as an athlete, you're basically dependent on dopamine. You've been flooding your system with dopamine every day for, you know, 2 to 6 to 3 to 4 to 5 hours a day. So your whole life ends up kind of revolving around dopamine and that feel good chemical, you know. And when, obviously, with sport, you're getting it in quite a healthy way. But then when you finish sport, you mightn't want to train anymore. You know, that's definitely something that athletes go through. They might, you know, go from literally doing 6 hours a day to doing nothing and actually relishing in the fact that they don't have to do any training. But the problem with that is that it actually upsets the brain chemistry that's been in place for, you know, up to 15, 16 years. So in order to seek out that dopamine, you know, they'll either do it the healthy way or the unhealthy way. And unfortunately, the unhealthy ways, the drugs, the gambling, all that kind of stuff, the alcohol, is a very easy way of doing it as well. So the unhealthy way can be a lot of fun for people, and then they get into it for that reason. But there's a point where fun becomes dependency, and then it's very hard for people to extract themselves from that. So if you're an Olympic level athlete, you're going to do most things to a very high level, and that includes the not so healthy stuff too, you know. So that's, people can fall down the rabbit hole and without the right guidance and without actually, because athletes as well are used to just doing stuff by themselves and just getting up, you know, stiff upper lip, getting on with it, and not really asking for help. And that's a big issue in retirement, because if you haven't asked for help your whole life, or if there's even a stigma around asking for help in the sporting world, you're not going to just going to suddenly do it when you're in trouble. In your retirement, you're conditioned not to do it. So not asking for help at the right time is definitely something that athletes struggle with, and it's definitely an issue for people who are struggling in retirement.
So from your point of view, when you were retiring and you couldn't find any information online as a self-help option, do you think that there are two aspects to this? One is career help, as in what am I going to do to earn a living after sport? And the other aspect is mental health, how I can ask for help.
Yeah, and the two are very much interlinked, and that's just something that crossing the line, that's kind of one of our main pillars really, is the integration of mental health and career development in one. Because it's connected to there's two reasons really why athletes kind of can go down the rabbit hole after they finish. But you know, one is, you know, moving on from the sport, you know, that's kind of a grief process that some people go through because they might have had to retire because of injury or deselection, you know, so it's been out of their own hands, you know. So there's that process, but there's also, you know, as I mentioned earlier on about my own experience, like that whole concept of what's your purpose now? Like what's gonna get you up in the morning and in the same way that rowing did? And that's a very hard question to answer unless you've done some really, you know, full on exploration about what that is. So your mental health is definitely tied into that, because if you can't answer those fundamental questions of who I am, who am I, what am I doing with my life, then that really can affect your mental health if that goes on for a prolonged period of time. I think human beings in general, it's, you know, we need a purpose in life, and the trouble with sport elite level is that people go for it 100% because you got to get the maximum out, because you've only got a certain amount of time to do and get your results. But you know, people forget that you could retire at the age of 25, 30, and you've got another 60 years of your life left. And that's a long time to be without a purpose. So developing a purpose and passion outside of sport is very important, because it's actually more important than the sport, because it's what's going to sustain you for 60 years. And it's probably what you're going to be remembered for at the end of the day, you know.
Very, very true. So let's focus back on to crossing the line sport, your business. What are the services and products that it sells?
Yeah, so, I mean, you mentioned earlier on about the fact that I came to you in the early days and, like, we talked about it and, you know, you were helping me with it and stuff. And since then, it's morphed completely in the direction that I wasn't expecting, which I think is a typical thing for startups. So initially, Crossing the Line was going to be just a website. So as I mentioned before, you know, a place where athletes can find, if they Google athlete retirement or athlete mental health, they'll find a one-stop resource that will have articles, resources, information, you know, athlete stories, all that kind of stuff. So they'll read a story that will be, and then they'll recognize something in them, and then that actually might help them. So it's not just the hard luck stories, obviously, as well. It's the good news stories and how people have transitioned well. So we started off with that, and then of course it became a case of like, well, this is great, but how are we going to survive? You know, we can't just survive with a website. So about 3 or 4 weeks after we launched, I got asked to do a couple of workshops in South Africa. And it was over there that I kind of thought to myself, wow, this is going to be a way that we're going to sustain ourselves is by education, educating the current crop of athletes and into this stuff and trying to prepare them for the end. And also the athletes who have retired as well, so those two strands. So that kind of morphed again into its current form, which is we do a few different things, and we have like three pillars basically that kind of underpin everything, which is Headspace, which covers mental health side of things, so talking about mental health in a really open way. The more openly you talk about it in sport, the less the stigma will be. The other pillar is career development, so passion and purpose, developing that outside your sport. And then the third pillar is tools for life, so basically equipping athletes with the tools that they need to succeed in life after sport, and actually getting them to develop the skills that they have already developed in sport and getting them to repurpose them in a way that they can use them later in life, because athletes are highly skilled people in lots of different areas, but they don't really realize that. So from those three pillars, we have a couple of tiers of service. So I guess the top tier would be we run like year-long personal development programs for teams. So that would include general psychology, so the Headspace counseling, one-on-one counseling integrated into career development counseling. The mentoring, we run a mentoring program, so we connect athletes with alumni from that particular sport who are now working in the working world and successful. And then we have our general service that we have for the public, which is the webinars, the personal development webinars, which can range from anything from mental health to career development. So it's definitely morphed. It's got a lot going on. We've got heaps going on, but I guess there are services really, and we have people can either choose to have all of that or they can choose to have some of it. And we have like our current clients at the moment include the Cannondale Dropback or Education First Dropback cycling team, the Australian rowing team, Australian volleyball team, Essendon Footy Club over here. So we're building our crop of clients in the, you know, for the long-term programs, but we're also building a good pool of people who are joining our webinars every 2 weeks. Rebecca?
Sorry, believe it or not, my power went off. But I'm fine now.
Okay.
Can you hear okay?
Did I lose you?
Brilliant. So you'll have two basic customers, sporting federations and individuals. Let's talk a little bit about sporting federations, because generally they are perceived as being responsible for delivering a successful team that, you know, competes at elite level. But of course, there are clubs for amateurs in every sport and schools and universities as well. How do you think their responsibilities lie for the well-being of their athletes?
Yeah, I think the world is changing. Even like in the time that I've been working in this area, it has definitely improved. Sports are actually taking a very active role in the development of their athletes as human beings now. There is a challenge for them though, in that like the same body that's selecting them is supposed to be looking after them as well, and that's quite a challenge. You know, so for athletes to actually trust that what they're saying won't get back to the coach. So one of our kind of strengths in that is that we're independent and we'll always be independent. So we're working for that team, but we never have to report to the coach about who we're seeing and what we're talking about. And the athletes value that a lot. So the way I see us fitting into the whole mix is that we're not here to take over. We're here to support the existing structures, because there is people that don't engage with the existing programs and clubs for that reason. And if we can be the stopgap, or the people that pick up those people, then everyone's going to get covered, you know. Also, like, there's so many ways to cover it. Like, so there's lots of topics. It's a very vast and complex topic. It's one federation can't really be asked to cover it all. So I guess when you have us in place, then we actually can cover a lot of bases for them as well. So
you're like a support service for athletes, just as many federations have external physiotherapy or strength and conditioning. You are exactly there to be the external support experts.
Exactly. And we're on call all the time, and the athletes can contact us anytime. And we try and impress on them that, like, this stuff that they're contacting us about, it could be something to do with their own lives and nothing to do with sport. But we believe that, if you're having trouble with your normal everyday life and you're struggling with something, that's going to have an impact on your performance, so general psychology, like just literally general counseling about life, that has a massive role to play in high performance sport, but it's never been given the airtime or the importance that it deserves. So you might be people concentrating on sports psychology, the psychology around making yourself quick, but what about the stuff that's, relationships, for instance, as an example, like if you're going through a relationship breakup, or if one of your family members is sick, who do you turn to then? And so we see that, of course, looking after the individual, the human being, but also that's actually, in helping the performance, because they will have somewhere to go to deal with that kind of stuff. Whereas, like, otherwise, they're just going to be bottling it up, and, it'll definitely impact their performance. So
let's be clear.
We believe the stuff that we do has a massive high performance gain, and this is where I think we can get people on board, we can get coaches on board and federations to buy in now, and especially the athletes, if they can buy into what we're doing now, in terms of them believing that working with us will improve their performance, then it has the byproduct of actually really assisting with their life after sport as well.
So let's be clear, this is not just for professional elite athletes. This is a service that's offered for anybody who enjoys sport and participates proactively in it.
Yeah, it's like, we have it on our website that it doesn't matter if you've gone to the Olympics or if you haven't gone to the Olympics. It's not all about elite sport. It's about anyone who's who's had a dream to achieve the highest level, who've pursued that goal. It doesn't matter what level they get to, the effects are still the same. So people shouldn't feel like embarrassed or bad about seeking help about this stuff if they've only gotten to club level. It's like, it doesn't matter. It's about actually striving for something, not getting there. It doesn't matter what level you got to, it's still the same feeling. So everyone can benefit from this stuff. And one of our things is the younger the better. So we work with lots of junior teams, because once the kids start hearing this language early, they're more likely to adopt it when they're older. So our goal, because we're heading towards charity status this year, is to be able to deliver this work for free to the grassroots clubs, and so that the next champions, wherever they are, will be clued up on the stuff before they even get to the elite level.
That's so important, because it is just another part of training. You're just training your mind as well as your body.
Absolutely. And it's often the mind that doesn't get any airtime.
So true. Now, you've very successfully run three conferences in the 2.5 years that Crossing the Line Sport has been going. Can you tell us a little bit about the most recent ones that you ran? What were they about?
Yeah, so we've run three, and one in Dublin in Trinity College. Then we ran one in, and two in Sydney, and so one at UT, University of Technology Sydney, and the last one we had in November was at the Ernst & Young EY building in Sydney. So they've morphed as well. So the first two were very discussion based. So we had four discussion topics during the day. Which were very good, like different panels talking about different stuff. We had some excellent athletes there of all levels. And then the last summit, which is the format we used, which I think is the one we're going to stay with, worked very well, was split the day up into two parts. First part was mental health. Second part was all about career development. And then each of those half days included a panel, two TED Talks, and a workshop. So people got actually to take home some valuable tools that they could use on their athletes and stuff, you know. So it was very much, yeah, focused on take homes. So on our first summit, we had Greg Louganis, the diver, four-time Olympic gold medalist. I think everyone would know him, not just for his diving prowess, but for the fact that he hit his head in the diving board in '88, and still went on to win. Extraordinary character. We also had Ben Johnson there, the infamous sprinter from the 1988 Seoul 100-meter race, and you know, at the last event we had in Sydney, Kim Brennan, our own Kim Brennan, who has actually helped us get our position, our event held in EY because she's now working for EY. And then we had a host of Australian athletes. We even had Mike Mackay from the Awesome Foursome. So a good spread, a lot of rowers there, of course, because of my own connection to rowing. Yeah, so we had some excellent conversations, and people were very forthcoming. It was actually interesting because all we were doing is holding the space, creating the space for them to be able to talk, and people talked a lot, and they talked very candidly, which was fantastic.
So, talk about Greg. What was Greg's story that he told at the conference?
So Greg's story is like multifaceted. You know, I said he's he's an extraordinary human. Like that's, you know, if you look at his diving, for instance, he was the first diver in history to get a perfect 10 score at the Olympic Games. So he won a silver in 76 when he was 16 years old, and then at 1980, the US didn't go to Moscow, they boycotted the game, so he missed out there. But in 84, he came back, won two gold medals in the springboard and the platform. And then in 88, he won two gold medals again. But between 84 and 88, he was diagnosed HIV positive actually just before the 88 Olympics. And he couldn't tell anybody that he had HIV because he wouldn't have been allowed to enter Seoul, or sorry, enter Korea if they had known. So he had to keep it secret. And he was on some really heavy medication because apparently he was close to going full-blown AIDS, right? And so he was very close to death. So they had to put him on this full-on medication that he had to take every 2 hours. They had to wake him up in the middle of the night. He had to wake up in the middle of the night to take them. So effectively, he went into the Seoul 88 Olympics with a death sentence hanging over his head, and he still managed to win despite banging his head on the diving board and everything. So his mental fortitude, resilience, all that kind of stuff was just like incredible. You just can't imagine what that must have been like. But the other aspect to him is obviously he was battling with depression his entire life, since he was a kid. So diving was very much a refuge for him. And then, of course, he was battling his sexuality as well. So he was in the closet for most of his career, but then came out kind of towards the end. And so throughout all that, he was still producing these magical performances. And Greg is very open about all that stuff, and you know, throughout his depression, he battled with drug addiction, alcohol, whilst he was still competing and stuff. So, yeah, it was amazing to have him there and just to be talking about all that kind of stuff, you know. And his whole mantra now is like just talk and get it out there, and because whatever you say, somebody will be listening in and it'll be helping someone, you know. He attempted suicide a bunch of times himself. Yeah, and I guess his message was really all about, well, you know, you can have all these issues and still be a champion. And that mental health problems are not confined, or they do exist in the athlete sphere. They do exist in the athlete community, and not just like up-and-coming athletes, but champions deal with this on a daily basis. So, yeah, he's been amazing at breaking down the stigma. So it was an honor to have him there, really. And he's a very good supporter of Crossing the Line. He's always been behind what we're doing. He's always retweeting us whenever he can and things like that. So he's, yeah, a great guy, you know.
So let's talk about mental depression as a symptom. If you are a coach or an athlete, what are the symptoms that you can look out for, either in yourself or in your colleagues?
Yeah, it's a very interesting one. And, you know, and there's like, there's a, just before I talk about it, there's actually a course that you can do, and it's not run by us or anything, but it's they have them in every country around the world. It's mental health first aid, and you can actually do mental health first aid, like focusing on youth, because obviously sport is a young person's domain. But that course actually teaches you to be, or how to react as a first responder to a mental health issue that somebody might present to you with, or that you might recognize. And it actually teaches you how to recognize it in people as well. So that's definitely be a course if you're working with young people, working in sport, at whatever role you have. It doesn't matter. You could be a sports administrator, you could be a physiotherapist, you could be a coach. It doesn't matter, because people, young people, can present with mental health problems to anyone. And I've heard stories about, you know, people who work in administration saying to me, like, oh, one of our athletes came to me, you know, saying that they were self-harming. Well, what do I do? You know, and that course teaches you exactly what to do in that situation. So I would highly recommend it to anyone listening. So people are chameleons in this regard, in terms of depression. I think we all know people who suffer from depression, and generally people who do, if they present any outward signs, they're at the point where they really need help, you know. And or if they articulate it, it means that they've been through a significant patch of time themselves where they've been battling it on their own. And so outward signs, you know, you can have anything from, if someone's normally very okay in the group and they start withdrawing, they stop talking, they get a little bit, you know, distant from the group, or they, you know, that's a sign that they mightn't be feeling so good about themselves within the group, or that they feel like their stature within the group has shifted for them. So that's definitely one sign to look out for sure. You know, and there's obviously signs if someone's a very good trainer, or they're someone who, you know, is always very reliable, or they're always very one who's upbeat, and then suddenly they did change and they're not that person anymore. That's an obvious sign. And you know, within the sporting realm, that can get missed very easily because people are so consumed by their own performances, coaches and athletes, that quite often, you know, other people's can get missed because you're too busy surviving yourself, you know, especially if you're not racing with them, or you're not rowing with them, or your performance isn't dependent on them, then you can totally miss them. So it's about being vigilant, really, and it's about the communication piece. And I think it's having these conversations, these open conversations with people all the time, saying, like, you know, talking about mental health
as if it's a normal thing, because it is a normal thing. Like it's part of our everyday life. It's our mental health fluctuates by the hour, let alone by the month, you know. So when it's talked about in that regard, it's actually the healthiest thing you could do. And it doesn't become this horrible thing that people are trying to avoid talking about. It becomes just a normal everyday thing, and it is. It's just something that I think society in general have got to accept, that we can't be up all the time. We have our down days, and that's fine. It's just part of life. But the sporting world doesn't allow that a lot of the time. That's a problem. And a lot, I think there's a lot of people wearing masks all the time, and we're all guilty of that. You know, there's no doubt about it. But in sport, there's definitely very much a put up or shut up mentality. That makes it very hard for this kind of stuff to be talked about.
So the solution, if you're in a sporting environment, or if you think you spot symptoms of depression, what should people do?
Yeah, so this mental health first aid course explains that really well. So it basically, what it does is it gives you a pathway. It gives you like an order in which to follow things, right? And it depends on the acuteness of the what's presented, right? So if someone presents with a, you know, I feel like committing suicide, that's an emergency response situation. So you've got to obviously make sure that you're safe, because if you're not safe, the other person's not safe, and then you make them safe, and then you call emergency. That's basically it, because that person is their life is at risk. So there's that level, and then there's, you know, at the other end of the spectrum, of someone who presents with being down, then you have to have a system of referral. So if they need help to see a psychologist, then having someone to refer them to, and being able to actually have the conversation with them over time about, I think you should, you know, be very helpful if you saw this person. You know, I'm not qualified to be a psychologist, so I can help you up to a certain point, but after that point you should see X. It's very, very important that you find that person. If you're a coach, or if you're an athlete, if one of your teammates presents to you with something like, that is very important for you to have that person that you trust, that they trust, and that, you know, that you can refer them to get help.
Thank you. That's great advice. Now we're just going to take a short break from our discussion with Geraint Towey. Support for today's Rowing Chat show comes from Health IQ, a life insurance agency who has the common sense to realise that athletes are healthier than the average population. There's no having to explain why your body is a high quality, amazingly fit asset. These guys know that you are less likely, in fact, 56% less likely to have heart disease if you're physically active. And rowers aren't just active, we're super active compared to the gym bunnies. Get special rates for life insurance and show your support for Rowing Chat by visiting healthiq.com/rowing and ask for your free quote. We know you all enjoy Rowing Chat, and so by following through on our sponsors, we can earn some money to pay our costs. Go on, do it now. Open that browser so you don't forget to get a quote. It's healthiq.com/rowing. Now, back to the show. I'm Gags to talk now about drugs in sport, and specifically drugs in rowing. Did you ever see anything during your international career that implied people were drug users?
Did I see anything? No, I didn't. But was stuff going on? I think that we'd have to be very naive to believe that rowing was is or was immune from doping, even systematic doping in certain teams. So, yeah, it's like, you know, because if you've won races at the top level, you have a belief that, you know, you can win clean, obviously. And then that belief will always keep with you the whole way through. But, you know, if you look over the rowing results in the years, you know, there is some crazy results out there, like for sure. And I think that, you know, sports like cycling and sports like, you know, athletics and whatnot, they have a bad rep. Yeah, there is absolutely a cultural, or was a very a bad cultural problem in cycling with drugs, and it got very exposed at a, you know, at the highest level it could. But to think that rowing is above all that, or was above all that, I think would be very naive. You know, the sport of rowing in general, like there's drugs out there that would be very are very good for rowing, you know, and we know that. And so, yeah, unfortunately, I don't believe that rowing is 100% clean, but I do believe, though, that there is clean people winning rowing races. And that's what's very refreshing about rowing, is that, like, there is clean people winning Olympic gold medals. And that's really good to see, you know. So I think, on average, I think our sport of rowing, I think it's one of the cleaner ones. But I, yeah, as I said, I think it'd be stupid of me to say that it's totally clean.
So let's lead on to talking about Ben Johnson. Now, Johnson, an incredible sprinter from Canada. What was his story that he told at your conference?
So Ben Johnson's story was very interesting, right? So he obviously he got busted in 1988 after the Olympic final, and he was stripped of his gold medal. Now, that final, as we all know, is regarded as the dirtiest final in history. And I think there's only one out of that final who hasn't tested positive for drugs in their lifetime. So back then it was kind of cowboy country, right? Like there was the level of doping was insane. And Ben believes to this day that he said that he was taking drugs, that he was doping, but he said the thing that he got busted for, he didn't take. He said he tried to take stenalazole, sorry about my pronunciation, but it made him sick. It gave him made him nauseous. So he changed to a different drug, equally potent, but didn't make him sick. And that's the one that he was taking at the Olympics. And he said, but he got popped for the other one, the one that did make him sick. So he believes that his drink was spiked in the weigh-in room. One of his opponents' track team came in chatting to him, and that he slipped this drug into his water bottle. And he maintains then that this guy admitted to it, but won't admit it in public. So that's Ben's story around all that. So he believes that, that was done to him. And he also believes that, you know, because he won the World Championships 2 years before, I think he was using Adidas shoes at time. And then he changed from Adidas to another brand. And he believes that he wasn't offered the protection that he had when he was running with Adidas shoes, and protection in the way of doping, protection from the doping authorities. So that's his story around the whole thing. It was a very interesting take and everything. I mean, he's been very open about it, all this kind of stuff. So, so he's admitted to doping, but he's kind of, at the same time, he believes he was totally screwed over by the powers that be. So
very interesting.
Yeah, but he was. But in terms of like somebody that I became good friends with, and I still am good friends with, who spoke at our last summit, Jörg Jaschke, who's a cyclist, ex-professional cyclist, who who came clean on his own doping. So he was cycling through the Lance Armstrong era, and he came clean on his own doping and what he took, when he took it, why he took it, who gave it to him, like everything, came clean on that about 10 years ago now. And he spoke at our summit about the culture that existed in cycling at the time. And I guess his message is around, you know, athletes making the right decisions. So ultimately, it comes down to the athlete makes the choice to dope. That's who it comes down to. Everything around the athlete might be like pushing him towards doping or facilitating the doping, but ultimately, it's the choice of the athlete. And so his big message, and this is actually, he worked with us in Crossing the Line. We did some work for ASADA, which is the Australian anti-doping body. We created videos, education videos for athletes with Jorg as the centerpiece. And that was our messaging. It was like, rather than kind of wag the finger and say, don't dope, it's like, we have to explain to athletes around what good decision-making is, decision-making skills, so that they actually have an informed opinion and decision on what they're doing and the consequences of that decision. So coming at it from the educational side rather than the finger-waggy side, you know?
Brilliant. And so what are informed decision-making skills?
Well, for instance, like as an example, Jorg would say, you know, you make a decision to dope to win a race in some obscure part of like Germany somewhere when you're 19 or 20. You make the decision to dope and then to win that race and then you get busted. In today's world, you're Googleable for life. So we talk about this in the video, Googleable. So for instance, when you go for a job 20 years later after you've left your sport, served your doping ban from the age of 19, you're trying to go for a job when you're 38, 39. And the first thing that they do when they get your CV is they Google your name. And the first thing they'll see is Joe Bloggs, doper. They're going to think twice about employing you, regardless of what the story was. You know, you can say till the cows come home, oh, my coach gave it to me. My coach said it was okay, but no, they don't care about that. It's about what decision you made at that point. So to think about an informed decision-making skills would be to say, okay, I'm going to make this decision now to dope, but hang on, this might impact my life in 20 years' time in a really negative way. And then you have the self-awareness. You're able to look at it from above and go, hang on, I'm not going to dope now because it might have really bad consequences for my life in the future. And he also talks about like the conversation you're going to have with your kids when they're, you know, when they get to a certain age and ask you, why did you cheat? You know, this kind of stuff. So it's about having the self-awareness to look forward in that situation when someone is asking you to dope, is to project yourself into the future and go, how is this going to impact my life? Who am I winning this race for? Am I winning this race for me? Or am I winning this race for my sponsors and my coach? And if the answer is in the latter, then you have to think twice about why you're making the decision to dope.
So that's very, very clear.
Yeah.
What about the other side of doping? Say you make a conscious decision not to dope. What about whistleblowing? Does an athlete have a responsibility to expose people who are encouraging doping or creating the circumstance to encourage it?
Yeah, well, it's definitely in Australia, and I'm pretty sure it's worldwide, is that when you sign the WADA code, you are actually, if you witness doping, you are obliged to report it. Otherwise, if you're complicit. And now in some countries like France, for instance, that would be illegal, because in France, doping is a crime. So yes, you are encouraged to report it. You know, and it's tricky because like, if you see somebody getting an injection, for instance, that mightn't be doping. But then again, it might, you know. So it's very, very difficult for athletes to do that. But there is I guess anonymous ways of doing it. So I think if people are in doubt, they should, of course. Like if you want to protect your own right to a fair race, by all means, you should report it. But protect yourself too. You know, just make sure that you're doing it the right way. That you know that by reporting this, that your own rights are being protected. But yeah, like, and if it's in a country like France, I'm not sure where else it's illegal. Yeah, if you don't report it and it gets out that you did see it, then yeah, you could be up for charges. Serious.
It is, isn't it? And it also has more than just personal consequences, as I think the current Sky cycling debacle in the UK is proving, that these things come back and back and back.
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, like earlier on, like that Googleable thing, it's never goes away, you know. And it's for life, you know. So it's for sure. Like, you know, you see people getting caught for this stuff like 8, 9, 10 years after the fact, you know. So it's absolutely, you know, I think people who do it are mad, you know.
So let's talk a little bit about serving your time after a doping ban. Do you think that doping bans should be for life?
It's a very interesting one, this one, because, you know, we're crossing the line. I at the beginning I said I want all athletes to be valued here. So like I find that athletes who have doped, either consciously or not, they have done this in the sporting world. It's in the sporting realm, and life after sport includes those people too, and so we have to look after those people too. And I think a lot of people who dope really get ostracized, and they have to deal with not only the life after sport question that all of us do, but they also have to deal with that shame and stigma that they've brought on themselves by doping. So there's a couple of not just a double-edged sword, there's like a triple-edged sword for those people, you know. And so, but I feel that like they have to be looked, you know, be facilitated in all this too. Whereas in fact, a lot of them get ostracized and they spend all that time alone, and it can have really, really devastating consequences for them. When I was rowing, definitely I would have been like going, anyone who dopes, okay, for me, there's a benefit of the doubt, right? So there's like, you get caught once, you have to serve 2 years, depending on the situation, right? 2 years for like a conscious doping thing, and then for, you know, other ones where it's an obvious and obviously a mistake, where there's been like a, I don't know, like a whereabouts infringement, or where it's proven that the supplement was tainted. Instances like that might be like 9 months, something like that. But if you do it twice, I think you forfeited your right to compete at the highest level. I think if it's proven that you've consciously doped twice, I think you've definitely, sorry, you know, competitive sport isn't the place for you. And that was my opinion when I was rowing. I think when I was rowing, I probably would have been one strike and you're out type of scenario. But I think now it's like would definitely be two strikes and you're out. And yeah, that's kind of where I'd sit with it, really. But the bit that I'm more concerned about in the whole thing is like that. Yes, somebody gets caught doping, they're given the ban. The radio silence that happens after that—that's an individual. They might have cheated, yes, but they're still a human, and they still need that. I guess support. You know, to understand why they did it first and foremost, and then to get on with the rest of their lives. And I don't think that's happening a lot. I think the people who dope, definitely they crawl under a rock and suffer, you know. And I think there has to be a space out there for them to actually feel like where they're welcome, and where they can actually go, okay, process what they've done and then just get on with the rest of their lives and be supported in doing that, you know. So I'm a full believer in that.
You have a very high emotional quotient. Thank you for that.
Thanks. I think you're the first person who said that to me.
I'll claim that honor. Now, we're coming towards the end of our time together.